the three major ways to engage the mind. First, be with the experience, writing it out mindfully, accepting it with a sense of curiosity and self-compassion. Second, let go of tension and emotion and step away from unhelpful thoughts or desires. Third, try to let in whatever might be beneficial, replacing what you have released with something that's useful or enjoyable. Practicing with second darts. Meanwhile, you can stop the first dart from triggering a salvo of second darts. This is where you can develop much influence over your own mind. To begin with, you can have a sense of perspective about first darts in general. They're a natural and unavoidable part of life, and we don't need to add our reactions to them. If a Sunday picnic is ruined by a sudden thunderstorm, it's unfortunate and unpleasant, but there's no sense in yelling at the rain. If you accept the first dart for what it is, that's like a circuit breaker interrupting the flow of second darts. In particular, it's useful to have perspective on first darts in relationships. For example, it's natural to care about how others see you. It's natural to feel unsettled if they are critical. This is the first dart. To leave it at that and not add second darts, here's a reflection about human evolution that's been very helpful to me. Altruism, giving to others at personal cost, is very rare in the animal kingdom. In most species, freeloaders can take advantage of altruism, which lowers the chances of survival of generous individuals and thus suppresses the evolution of altruism in that species. Human altruism, helping strangers, jumping into a river to rescue someone else's dog, was able to develop because the evolving social brain enabled our ancestors to understand and care deeply about what others thought of them. Living in small groups, sometimes on the edge of starvation, a person's reputation was a life and death matter. Imagine being on the plains of Africa 100,000 years ago. If you shared your food with someone yesterday, and then that person refused to share food with you today, everyone in the band would know about it, and no one would share food with that person again. Consequently, freeloaders could not get away with exploiting the generosity of others. The priority that people place on what others think about them creates our vulnerability to embarrassment, hurt, and shame, but it is also what enables altruism. Similarly, our vulnerabilities to loneliness, envy, resentment, and indignation are necessary features of the deeply social human nature that also gives us friendship, compassion, love, and justice. When you know this, first starts in relationships make more sense, so they don't seem as alarming. They're normal, a natural sort of pain. When you see that they've been shaped by millions of years of evolution, they don't feel so immediate and penetrating and personal. Painful as they are, they're in the service of a good cause. Experiencing them is a little like taking one for the human team. Building on this sense of perspective about first darts, try to work with second dart reactions inside yourself. By the way, later chapters will address skillful ways to interact with others. Inside yourself, take a breath, step back, and recognize second darts for what they are, needless suffering. Observe them revving up and see how they try to hijack your attention. If you're ruminating about an issue with someone, focus your attention on self-compassion. Then try to focus on experiencing key resources that are matched to the issue, such as bringing to mind other people who do care about you. If you don't add fuel to second darts, they tend to run out of gas on their own. For example, if you stop building up a case in your mind about people who've wronged you, your resentments will probably fade into the background. In particular, watch out for the inner critic, a major thrower of second darts. Stand up to the inner critic. There are two different attitudes or quote-unquote voices inside us all, one that is nurturing and another that is critical, one that lifts up and one that weighs down. This is perfectly normal, not psychotic. Each of these parts of you has a role to play. The inner nurturer brings self-compassion and encouragement. The inner critic helps you recognize where you've gone wrong and what you need to do to set things right. But for most people, the inner critic goes way overboard, throwing second dart after second dart of scolding, shaming, nitpicking, and fault-finding. It's big and powerful, while the inner nurturer is small and ineffective, which wears down mood, self-worth, and resilience. Happily, there are good ways to reset this balance by restraining the critic and strengthening the nurturer inside yourself. Be mindful of self-criticism. Try to observe how self-criticism operates inside you. Notice any dismissal or minimization of your pain, your needs, and your rights. Watch how little streams of thought downplay your accomplishments, such as, "Oh, anyone could have done that. But it wasn't perfect. What about the other times when you messed up?" Observe any repetitive doubting or discouraging of your hopes and dreams. See if you're raining on your own parade. Be aware of anger at yourself that seems out of proportion to whatever happened, and listen inside for a tone of scolding, berating, or shaming, like someone is yelling at you. Recognize any underlying attitude that you always have to do more to be good enough. Identify any over-the-top moralistic self-condemnation, such as, "You should be ashamed of yourself. You're a bad person." As you observe what's happening in your mind, try to label it to yourself, such as self-criticism, or saying my pain doesn't matter, or lashing and lambasting again. See if there is anything familiar about the words, tone, or attitude in the self-criticism. Does it remind you of anyone, such as a parent, older sibling, or coach? Consider how self-critical attitudes developed inside you, perhaps when you were younger. When you're mindful in these ways, you can learn about yourself and see the dogmatism, harshness, and absurdity in much of what the inner critic has to say. Stepping back from the critic to observe it stops reinforcing it and helps you disidentify from it. You may have it, but you don't need to be it. And in your brain, you'll be associating a calm witnessing to the inner critic, in effect, a form of linking, which can make it less intense and more reasonable. Strengthen the inner nurturer. When the inner critic starts pounding away, the inner nurturer is a refuge and an ally. This part of yourself is protective and encouraging when other people are critical of you, and when things are stressful, disappointing, even terrible. It is a major source of confidence and resilience. Starting in early childhood, we develop the inner nurturer by internalizing experiences with outer nurturers, such as parents, preschool teachers, and older children. But if external nurturance was spotty, or if it was compromised in some way, such as by having a parent who is both loving and intensely critical, then self-nurturance doesn't become as strong as it should be. No matter what happened in your past, these days you can build up an inner nurturer by using the heal steps to internalize experiences in which others are caring toward you, growing a natural, lasting sense of caring for yourself from the inside out. Additionally, when you are caring toward yourself, such as telling yourself that a small mistake is not a big deal, take in these experiences, which will strengthen your inner nurturer. It may sound silly, but you could imagine a caring committee inside yourself with different characters on it who represent various kinds of support and wisdom. My caring committee includes my wife and kids, tough but kind rock climbing guides, several close friends, and even some fictional characters, including Gandalf from The Lord of the Rings, Spock from Star Trek, and the plump fairy godmother from the story of Sleeping Beauty. Really? Who's on your own caring committee? When the inner critic gets going, or when life is challenging, call on the inner nurturer. Get to know the feeling of it, the sense of it in your body, the attitudes it has, the advice it gives you. You could start by recalling someone who's been very caring toward you, and then shift your attention to a more general feeling of being sheltered, comforted, or guided. And when you have a sense of the inner nurturer, focus on this experience and take it in. One more opportunity to reinforce the nurturer inside yourself. Push back against the critic. As soon as you recognize the characteristic tone or words of the inner critic, be skeptical about it. It's guilty until proven innocent. Make a fundamental choice about whether you want to join with it and believe it, or instead separate from it and doubt it. The inner critic usually gets more powerful when others have been nasty, belittling, or mean toward you. What they did to you is wrong, and it's not right to do it to yourself. Argue against the inner critic, and truly intend to win. Write down one of its typical lines, such as, "You always fail," and then write down three or more believable rebuttals, such as some of the many times you have succeeded. Imagine members of your caring committee sticking up for you and talking back to the critic. Ally with them, not with it. Talk to yourself in useful ways, such as, "This criticism has a grain of truth in it, but everything else is exaggerated or untrue." Or, "This is what so-and-so used to tell me. It was wrong then, and it's wrong now." Or, "This is not helping me, and I don't have to listen to it." Try regarding the inner critic as something that lacks credibility. You could imagine it as a ridiculous character, like a silly cartoon villain in a Disney movie. Place it over there, as it were, in your mind, outside the core of your being, like that annoying person in a meeting who is always critical, but whom everybody tunes out after a while. Use the link step to sense that reassurance and encouragement are sinking down into places inside that have been criticized and have felt inadequate or ashamed. Feel a soothing and calming spread inside you. Rest in a peaceful worth and confidence. Know you're a good person. Think about someone who you feel is a basically good person. No need to be a saint, just someone with a core of decency and caring. Then think about someone else you consider to be a basically good person. Notice how often you see good qualities in others, even people you don't know that well. Turn it around and understand that most people are like you. They, too, routinely recognize that someone is a basically good person. In fact, they routinely recognize that you are a basically good person. Let it sink in that what you feel about others, they feel about you. They feel it because they see it. You're not tricking or fooling them. They know you have flaws and faults, and it doesn't matter. The key people in your life still think you are a basically good person. Can you see yourself the way others see you, as essentially good and worthy? For many people, this is quite hard to do. Seeing others as good people seems straightforward. You might also recognize intellectually that others see your good intentions and warm heart. But seeing yourself in this way? It's oddly difficult for most of us. It can feel like a taboo of sorts, something that's just not allowed. But why not? If it's all right to recognize basic goodness in others, and it's all right for them to recognize it in you, why is it not all right to recognize it and stand up for it inside yourself? As you go through your day, try to register it when others see decency, capability, effort, and caring in you, typically in small passing moments that are nonetheless real. Also recognize your own good qualities much as you would see them in others. Label them in your mind as a fair-minded observer would, such as trying hard, being friendly, admitting a mistake, being skillful, contributing, enduring when things are hard, or giving love. Be aware of the integrity and lovingness deep inside you, even if they're not always apparent or expressed. Let a sense of confidence in your inherent value grow and fill your mind. Let it sink in. Try to do this again and again. Knowing in your heart that you are a basically good person is a true refuge. No matter the ups and downs of successes and failures, loves and losses, you can find comfort and strength in this knowledge. Independent of all achievements, fame, and fortune, there is always goodness in the core of your being. Key points. Humans evolved to be dependent upon each other. When others are dependably helpful and caring, especially when we are young, we develop a sense of security and internal stability. But if others are distant or rejecting, we feel insecure and become less resilient. No matter what has happened to you in the past, you can become more secure inside yourself. To do this, look for opportunities to feel cared about and take these experiences into yourself. Develop a coherent narrative about your childhood. And be dependably empathic and caring toward others. When difficult things happen to us, we often add a second wave of reactions to the initial pain or upset. These, quote-unquote, second darts create so much of our suffering, especially in relationships. Try to be mindful of them, disengage from them, and stop fueling them. A major source of second darts is the inner critic. It tries to be helpful, but goes overboard with scolding and shaming. This erodes self-worth and makes it harder to bounce back from disappointment or failure. Strengthen the inner nurturer and then push back against the inner critic. You routinely recognize that others are basically good persons. Well, they see that about you. Help yourself know that you are a basically good person. Whatever happens outside you or to you, the foundation of lasting confidence is the sure knowledge that there is goodness at the heart of you. Part 3, Regulating. Chapter 7, Calm. You are the sky. Everything else, it's just the weather. Pema Chodron. Forrest and I once went whitewater rafting on the Klamath River in Northern California. Our guide took us through steep drops that drenched us with spray, and it was tons of fun, plus a great lesson. The rapids were dangerous and challenged our need for safety. But I remember the guide's face, careful yet sure of himself, alert yet relaxed, as he handled the hazards around us. He had calm, the mental resource that helps us stay in the green zone as we deal with pain or the threat of it. Everyone has physical or emotional pain some of the time, and many people experience it all of the time. Besides actual pain, threats of pain come from many directions, from trucks driving too close to your car, to irritation flickering across the face of your partner. Even pursuing opportunities can bring the threat of pain. For example, one of the scariest experiences of my life was telling my first real girlfriend that I loved her while not knowing what she would say in return. Oof, she said she loved me too. When faced with pain or the threat of it, you might be able to stay calm like the guide. But it's common to be triggered into flight, fight, or freeze reactions with some combination of fear, such as uneasiness, nervousness, worry, anxiety, alarm, or panic. Anger, such as exasperation, annoyance, irritation, indignation, rage. Or helplessness, such as a sense of overwhelm, impotence, defeat, futility, or paralysis. It's normal to experience fear, anger, or helplessness from time to time. Problems arise when these reactions are invasive, chronic, or otherwise impact your well-being, relationships, or work. Because the need for safety is so vital, it's equally vital that we regulate ourselves to meet pain and threats with calm strength. To help you do this, we'll explore relaxing and centering, seeing threats accurately, feeling safer, and cooling anger. And for any feelings of helplessness, go back to the section on agency in Chapter 4. Relaxing and centering. As Alan Watts said, life is wiggly. Inside the body and mind, things are continually changing, for better or worse. Plus, we live in an increasingly volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous world whose ripples surge through us each day. The healthy resting state. To keep you on an even keel as you ride the inner and outer waves, the autonomic nervous system manages your body and mind through its parasympathetic and sympathetic branches. Think of these like the brake and gas pedals of a car. The quote-unquote rest and digest parasympathetic nervous system evolved first, before the sympathetic nervous system developed. When it is engaged, the heart rate slows down and the body refuels and repairs itself. Extreme parasympathetic activation can produce an intense freeze response, such as feeling like you can't speak, the human equivalent of an animal playing dead. But normal parasympathetic activity feels good, with a sense of relaxed, centered well-being. On the other hand, the sympathetic nervous system puts the pedal to the metal, mobilizing the body for action by speeding up the heart, while hormones such as adrenaline and cortisol course through the blood. As the body revs up, so does the mind, with more intense thoughts and feelings. As we'll hear in the next chapter, sympathetic activation is a wonderful source of passion and resilience when it's combined with positive emotions such as happiness, love, and confidence. The healthy resting state of your body and mind involves substantial parasympathetic activity with just enough sympathetic activation to keep things interesting. But when sympathetic nervous system activation is combined with negative emotions such as anger or fear, these fight or flight reactions are stressful and upsetting. They burden your body and mind and strain your relationships. Unfortunately, our modern go, go, go culture routinely pushes people into sympathetic nervous system overdrive with few opportunities for sustained parasympathetic recovery. There can also be individual reasons for sympathetic activation, such as having a driven personality or being on edge as a result of past trauma. Many of us experience chronic mild to moderate stress, living much of the time in a kind of pink zone. A person could slow down and do less, but the realities of work and family often make this hard to achieve. If you are going to stay busy while juggling many balls and plates, it helps to keep engaging the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system along the way. One of the best ways to do this is through frequent practices of relaxation. Settling down. The parasympathetic and sympathetic branches of the nervous system are connected like a seesaw. If one goes up, the other is pushed down. As you relax, parasympathetic activation increases, which decreases sympathetic activity and related stress hormones. If you use the heel steps to internalize repeated experiences of relaxation, your baseline sense of life will become less pressured, anxious, or irritable. Then if you do start to feel tense or upset, you'll be able to return more quickly to a calm and centered place inside. Relaxation comes easily when we're at leisure, such as walking in the woods. But that's not the only time we can feel it or need it. A basketball player shooting a free throw in overtime must be able to relax and let muscle memory take over. In even more extreme situations, as Adam Savage put it, calm people live, tense people die. I learned this myself when I nearly drowned at age 16, skin diving in the Pacific Ocean. After holding my breath as long as I could, I tried to swim back up through a patch of kelp, but the seaweed snared me. I panicked and fought it, but just got more tangled up. I was running out of air and was sure I would die. Then, from somewhere came a thought I remember to this day. Cool it. I relaxed. My thrashing had ripped the snorkel out of my mouth, the mask was around my neck, and I'd lost a fin. I'd been underwater a long time. Still, I moved slowly to disentangle myself, working my way up through the orange-brown kelp. Finally, I cleared it and rose to the silver-bright surface in a welcome gulp of air. There are some things about that experience I don't fully understand, including what said cool it. But the value of relaxation could not have been clearer. To establish a calmer baseline for yourself, plus recover more quickly after stress, set aside a few minutes or more to relax deeply many times a week. Also look for little moments to relax in the flow of your day, especially when the needle of your personal stressometer starts creeping up into yellow, orange, or red. In our overheated culture, relaxation needs to be a conscious priority. Many things are soothing and settling, and most can be used for longer or shorter periods. Here are some good ways to relax, and you can use the heel steps to take in these experiences. Extend the exhalation. The parasympathetic nervous system manages exhaling and slows your heart rate, while the sympathetic nervous system handles inhaling and speeds up the heart. If you lengthen your exhalation, that naturally engages the parasympathetic nervous system. For several breaths or more, try counting softly in your mind to make your exhalation longer than your inhalation. For example, inhale for 1, 2, 3, and then exhale for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Release tension. Pick a key region such as your jaw muscles or the diaphragm under your ribcage. Bring awareness to the area and deliberately relax it. You could imagine breathing into this area or that light or energy is flowing through it and carrying tension away. If you like, try progressive relaxation, in which you start at your feet and move up to your head, systematically releasing tension in each major part of your body. You can also start at your head and move downward. Try biofeedback. Various products use wearables or clips on an earlobe or finger to track your heart rate and breathing. Using real-time feedback from your body, you're guided to a calmer place and you can see your progress over time. Some of these products aim at improving heart rate variability, the change in the interval between heartbeats that reflects the degree to which your heart rate slows as you exhale and engage the parasympathetic nervous system. Increased variability is a marker of greater parasympathetic activation in general and is associated with improved mood, a stronger immune system, and greater resilience to stress. Move. Yoga, Tai Chi, Qigong, walking meditation, dancing, singing, and other structured forms of movement are relaxing and often energizing as well. You could also pick a routine activity, such as raking leaves or folding laundry, and do it in a very calm and easygoing way while staying in touch with your body. Use imagery. Much of our stress is driven by internal verbal processes. These worry about the future, rehash the past, and mutter about the present. In most people, the neural basis for language is on the left side of the brain, while the right side handles imagery and other forms of holistic processing. By the way, this is reversed for many left-handed people. The two sides inhibit each other, so if one becomes more active, that quiets the other. Consequently, focusing on imagery will reduce verbal activity and help you relax. There are many ways to explore imagery. You could recall a beautiful place you have visited and walk through it again in your mind. Imagine being in a relaxing situation, such as sitting by a lake or walking down a country road. Think back on a setting you felt good in, such as your grandparents' home, and recall as many details about it as possible. You could visualize fluffy white clouds, and if you like, soaring happily through them like a bird. Recognizing paper tiger paranoia. Sometimes fear is obvious, such as feeling nervous or panicked. But much of the time, fear operates behind the scenes and exercises a hidden power. For example, fear is at work when a person stays within a small comfort zone, procrastinates to avoid a challenge, feels emotionally inhibited, or avoids speaking up and standing out. Fear is so powerful because it's so fundamental to survival. The ways that we experience and try to cope with seemingly minor concerns today are shaped by the same neurohormonal machinery that helped our ancestors react to lethal threats and survive another day. The two mistakes. As the nervous system evolved, animals could, metaphorically speaking, make two kinds of mistakes. One, believe there is a tiger in the bushes when there isn't one. Or two, believe there is no tiger when one is about to pounce. In the wild, what's the cost of the first mistake? Needless anxiety, which is uncomfortable, but not fatal. What's the cost of the second mistake? A good chance of death. Consequently, Our ancestors developed a strong tendency to make the first mistake again and again in order to avoid making a second mistake even once. In effect, we're adaptively paranoid of paper tigers. As a result, most people overestimate threats while underestimating their resources for managing them. These biases operate in the background and are often hard to see, which makes them very powerful. I had been a dorky, shy kid in school, and as an adult, I just took it for granted that if I stood out in a group, bad things would happen. It was a long time before I became aware of this assumption and realized that most people are not mean and rejecting. Once a bias is established, we focus on and internalize the information and experiences that confirm it, while ignoring or downplaying whatever might contradict it. Until I started to understand my own biased expectations about groups, the many times I was warmly included, quote-unquote, didn't count, while the few times I was brushed aside seemed to prove that my fears had been justified all along. Needless anxiety. It's obviously important to recognize real threats and develop resources for handling them. But most people feel more anxious than is necessary or helpful. We tend to see ourselves, the world around us, and the future through fear-colored glasses. Even when you know rationally that there is absolutely nothing to fear, there is still often a background trickle of anxiety, a sense that something could go wrong at any minute. Anxiety functions as a signal of danger, but much of the time it is only noise, like a car alarm that's stuck, blaring away, unpleasant but meaningless. And what are the costs? Anxiety feels bad, and it's stressful and fatiguing. Flooded with false alarms, it's easy to miss real threats, especially those that grow slowly over time, such as an emotional distance creeping into a marriage. Feeling anxious, we can overreact and become threatening to others, who overreact themselves and confirm our fears. Needless fear makes us shift resources from approaching opportunities to avoiding exaggerated threats. Anxiety increases defensiveness, paralysis by analysis, and immobilization. In relationships, fear makes people cling more tightly to us while being more suspicious and aggressive toward them. All of this makes a person less resilient. Feeling safer. Fear arises when threats seem bigger than resources. Sometimes this is actually the case, such as getting an unexpected bill that you don't have the money to pay. But due to paper tiger paranoia, threats often look larger than they really are, while resources look smaller than they really are. Even if you realize that fear plays an irrationally large role in your life, it can still be hard to let go of it. Many people are afraid, in effect, of not being afraid, since that's when their shields come down. Then they fear that, whap, something might hurt them. To be safer, we need to decrease actual threats and increase actual resources. To feel safer, we need to stop inflating threats and start recognizing all our resources. Then we don't have to be afraid of not being afraid. Let's say you're doing what you can to reduce the actual threats in your life while developing real resources for handling them. Meanwhile, make sure you are seeing threats clearly, appreciating your resources, and feeling as safe as you reasonably can. Seeing threats clearly. Pick one thing that worries you. It could be an illness, finances, or a conflict with another person. It could also be an area of life in which you're holding back to reduce risks, such as avoiding public speaking or not asking for what you really want in a relationship. You can do the process that I'll be guiding you through here by reflecting to yourself, journaling, or talking about it with someone, and you can use it with multiple things that worry you. How big is it? Be specific and concrete about the size of the challenge. In effect, put a fence around the issue rather than letting it be nebulous and overwhelming. For instance, instead of saying to yourself, my health is bad, how about saying to yourself, I have high blood pressure, bound the issue in space and time. What part of your life does it affect, and what is unaffected? When does it happen, and when is it not very relevant? How likely is it? Perhaps you're stuck with an ongoing condition, such as a chronic health issue. But most of the time when we feel anxious, it's about something bad that might happen. There is a threat of pain, but not pain itself. For instance, a person might think, I could get sick. Or, if I express anger, no one will want me. If what you are concerned about is a possibility, but not yet a reality, ask yourself, what are the odds, actually? In your past, a certain kind of bad event could indeed have been likely, perhaps because of the people you lived with or knew back then. But today, things are different, and the chances of a bad event are probably much lower. How bad would it actually be? What would you experience if the threat did come true? Let's say you're afraid of someone rejecting you if you're more vulnerable or assertive. Okay, suppose the feared event occurs. What would you actually feel if it happened? On a 0 to 10 scale, say, with 10 being the absolute worst imaginable, how bad would you feel? And for how long? In the past, similar events could have felt truly horrible, especially during childhood when things are felt more keenly before the nervous system fully matures. But these days, as an adult, you have many more inner shock absorbers. There's a good chance that you wouldn't feel as bad or for as long as you fear you would. Let the good news land. Let all this sink in. It is really, really true. You can believe it. Let yourself feel convinced of it. Using the heal steps, open to relief and reassurance about this good news. Take it into yourself, easing and gradually replacing excessive, needless alarm and tension and anxiety. Appreciating your resources. Then ask yourself this. Given the actual magnitude of the thing you fear, the odds of it happening, and the intensity of its impact, how would you cope with it? For example, suppose you discover a flat tire on your car. It's a hassle for sure, but it's not such a big problem if you know how to change a tire or if you can call a tow truck. Resources in your mind. Think about times when you've drawn on inner strengths, such as grit, confidence, and compassion, to handle issues in the past. Then, take some moments to consider how you could tap into those inner strengths again to deal with the current challenge. Also consider the talents and skills that you could bring to bear. How could you work on the problem? What plans could you make to prevent it, manage it, or recover from it? Think about other resources inside yourself, such as mindfulness and your own good heart. Resources in your body. How has your body served you so far? How could it serve you again? See if you can tune into its natural vitality. Feel what is strong about it, energetic and capable. Imagine some of the ways that your body could help you with this challenge. Resources in your world. There are many resources around you, such as friends, family, and acquaintances. How could they be useful? Consider both concrete help and emotional support. Think about a pet if you have one. My worries always felt lighter with our cat in my lap. If need be, could you get professional help, perhaps from a doctor, lawyer, or accountant? Think about the things you own and consider how you could use them for this challenge. Feeling deeply resourced. As you reflect on these resources, let your thoughts about them become feelings of enoughness, reassurance, and relief. Use the heal steps to enrich and absorb these feelings. If you like, use the link step to use these positive feelings to soothe and replace any sense of anxiety. Feeling as safe as you reasonably can. After one of my first days of rock climbing, I had a weird experience when I went to sleep. Suddenly and vividly, I was falling off the top of the cliff and plummeting down to smash into gray granite. I jerked awake before hitting it. After a few minutes, I drifted off and was again falling to my death, waking up just before impact. After this happened several times, I stopped trying to fight it. As I slid into drowsiness, I let myself imagine that I was tumbling down the face of the cliff to splatter on a slab at the bottom. At the instant of impact, a kind of inner light bulb went off. It dawned on me that I'd spent the day shoving down all of my fears of falling, and they were now boiling back up. I realized there was a sweet spot in which I could feel appropriate anxiety while also functioning effectively and happily, even 1,000 feet off the ground. It's important not to suppress fear or overlook what it's trying to tell you. Reasonable concerns are your friend, keeping you out of potentially dangerous situations. But being consumed, invaded, and compromised by fear doesn't make you safer. If anything, the distractions of excessive fear and its wear and tear on the body actually undermine your safety. A little fear goes a long way, and it doesn't have to penetrate your core and push you into the red zone. One of my favorite sayings from the Buddha is, quote, "Painful feelings arose, but they did not invade my mind and remain," unquote. Use fear. Don't let it use you. And, as we've seen, there need not be much fear at all. Most of the time, the threats we imagine aren't as likely as we think they are. Their consequences won't be so bad, and we'd be more able to cope than we give ourselves credit for. It's like walking around believing that the world is at threat level orange, when in fact it's more like threat level chartreuse, a bucket of green paint with a drop of yellow. If you're about to fall off a cliff, or the equivalent, sure, be afraid. But otherwise, repeatedly help yourself feel as safe as you reasonably can as you move through your day. And to deepen this experience, try this experiential practice. Experiential practice, feeling safer now. Take some breaths and really relax. Be mindful of any tension, uneasiness, or worry. Step back from any anxiety and observe it. Let it be and let it come and go. Let fear in any form move to the background of awareness. And in the foreground, bring to mind things that protect you. Be aware of the solidity of the floor beneath your feet, the stability of a chair, the sheltering of a roof over your head. Be aware of your clothing, shoes, and other things that protect you. As you recognize these protections, open to feeling increasingly protected. Be aware of things around you that are protective, such as stop signs and hospitals. Keep opening to feeling protected. Allow a sense of protection and safety to sink in, becoming a part of you. Recognize some of the many resources in your life that could help you be safe, such as people who wish you well, who would stand with you and for you. Also recognize resources inside you, such as endurance and determination. Open to feeling that there is a lot you can draw on. Challenges will come, but you've got many ways to deal with them. Keep opening to feeling safer. Let needless worry fall away. Let go of any tension. Let a sense of safety sink in and spread inside you. Notice that you are basically all right right now. You may not have been all right in the past, and you may not be all right in the future. But in this moment, you are okay, protected, and resourced. There may be pain, there may be hurt or sorrow off to the edges of your mind, but there is no mortal threat, no tiger about to pounce. You are fundamentally safe. Moment after moment, breath after breath. Your heart is still beating. You are going on living. You are still all right. Let thoughts and feelings come and go. Abide with ease at the front edge of now. You are still breathing just fine. The next moment is passing through. You're still okay. You're safe now. Safe in this moment. Moment after moment. Basically all right. Right now. Cooling anger. Anger is a natural response to pain, frustration, attack, and injustice. As someone who grew up in a home in which the parents had a monopoly on anger, it took me a while to learn that experiencing and expressing this emotion was an important way to accept and stand up for myself. Throughout history, different kinds of people, such as children, women, and religious and ethnic groups, have had their justifiable anger brushed aside, explained away, or attacked. It's especially important to make room in your mind for anger if others have tried to banish it. Anger mobilizes energy and shines a bright light on whatever is at issue. Nonetheless, anger also comes wrapped with tension, stress, and threats to relationships. Frequent or chronic anger is fatiguing. Like hot acid, it eats away at physical and mental health. Of all the emotions we express to each other, anger usually compels the most attention, like a red light flashing, danger. Then we react to the other person's anger with our own anger, creating vicious cycles in relationships. Cooling down anger does not mean enabling injustice or turning into a patsy. You can still be strong and forceful. Think of times when you or others were determined, passionate, or assertive while still not being swept away with anger. The art is to receive and use the gift, the positive functions of anger, while being careful about the wrapper. This means managing and expressing anger in skillful ways while also addressing the issues that underlie it. Be mindful of anger. Anger is often at work in the back of the mind, and recognizing its presence enables you to control it rather than it controlling you. Try to be aware of anger in its many shades and intensities, from mild exasperation to violent rage. When you feel angry in any way, explore the experience, including its sensations, feelings, thoughts, and desires. Anger is layered, and its brittle, hot, aggressive surface usually rests on a soft, vulnerable, anxious foundation of unmet needs, especially safety, since anger is a primal reaction to threat. Anger is a messenger. What is it telling you about your deeper frustrations, unfulfilled longings, and emotional pain? Try to accept your experience and have compassion for yourself. As you open to and be with this deeper material, anger itself tends to let go. Beware the rewards that come with anger. There are four major types of negative emotions, namely sadness, anxiety, shame, and anger. Of them, anger is the most seductive. Most people don't enjoy feeling glum worried, or inadequate. But the surge of righteous indignation and energy that comes with anger can feel stimulating, organizing, as it draws together the threads of a scattered mind and identifies a clear target, and even pleasurable. Anger is also an effective way to hide hurt and vulnerability, assert status or dominance, push away fear, and compensate for feeling small or weak. In relationships, arguing or bickering can serve the purpose of keeping others at a comfortable distance. A saying describes anger as a poisoned barb with a honeyed tip. I've spent more hours than I'd like to admit tasting that honey while ruminating angrily about how I'd been wronged. Meanwhile, the poison was seeping in, stressing and upsetting me while priming me to overreact in the future. Try to be mindful of the process of getting angry, which typically happens in two stages, the priming and the trigger. In the first stage, little things add up. Some are general, including stress, weariness, and hunger. Others are more specific, such as the small moments of feeling misunderstood, let down, or hassled that gradually sensitize you to a particular person. It's like someone dragging a fingernail across the back of your hand. The first dozen times don't matter much, but by the 100th time it happens, you naturally flinch and pull back. Even minor experiences can build up like a pile of unlit matches. Then, in the second stage, some kind of spark lands and starts a fire, often way out of proportion to the trigger itself. For example, when our kids were young and cluttering the floor with their toys and shoes, if I was in a good mood, I hardly noticed their stuff. But if I was tired at the end of a frustrating day, the priming, and stubbed my toe on a fire truck, the trigger, kaboom. In the moment of being angry, we tend to presume that it is justified by whatever happened. Well, of course I'm mad. But usually, most of the anger has been fueled by the priming and is out of proportion to the trigger itself. Be skillful with anger inside yourself. In Chapter 10, Courage, we'll explore how to assert yourself effectively. Here, I would like to focus on how to deal with anger inside your own mind. Then, when you do communicate with others, things are likely to go better. Recognize how anger hurts you. There's a proverb that says, getting angry at others is like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both people get burned. Because anger can feel both rewarding and justified, it helps to realize that it is a toxic burden on you, in addition to its consequences for others. Take some time to consider the cost of anger for you personally, both these days and over the past years of your life. Think about how it makes you feel. Think about its effects on your sleep, body, and health, and its effects on your relationships at home or work. Even when anger is kept inside, it eats away at a person. You may have heard it said that resentment is like taking poison and waiting for others to die. After reflecting on all this, decide in your heart how you want to relate to and manage anger. Decide how you want to address its underlying causes, such as physical pain or being mistreated by others. And decide how you want to express it. Help yourself have a sense of conviction about these decisions and take in this feeling of commitment. Reduce the priming. Over the course of your day, be aware of the run-up to anger and intervene early as best you can. For example, take a break to clear your head from work before talking about homework with your teenager, or remind yourself to be extra careful with your words when your back is hurting. Recognize if you've become sensitized to a person, setting, or topic. If you have, name it to yourself so it has less power over you. Such as thinking to yourself, I'm edgy about visiting the in-laws again. Or, I've had it up to here with being constantly interrupted in this meeting. Or, I'm frustrated that nobody helps with the dishes. When things do go awry, try to react in proportion to the trigger itself without the amplifying effect of the priming. Ask yourself how you'd react if the trigger, the situation, event, words, or tone were happening for the first time. Put the trigger in perspective. On your "this is bad" scale, running from 0 to 10, how bad is the trigger, really? How long will its effects last? Will you even remember it in a couple of days? This is not about minimizing the trigger, but about seeing it clearly. It has helped me so many times to realize that what had happened was in fact a 2, but my anger was surging to a 7. When I recognized this, I could be with the hot wave of overreactions while also keeping my own words and tone as close to a 2 as possible. Then, after you've dealt with the trigger itself, you can address what has caused the priming. Disengage from righteousness. It's useful to have values and standards, but if you add righteousness to them, with its dogmatism and superiority, this adds fuel to your anger, triggers reactions from others, and undermines your credibility. The righteous case we develop about people is like a river in flood carrying the boat of anger. In your mind, try to separate any all-knowingness or "I'm better than you" from the actual heart of the matter. For example, it's one thing to want roommates to do their dishes, but it's something else to think they're lazy, selfish slackers if they don't. Recognize what righteousness is like as an experience. Perhaps with a tightening around your eyes and prosecutorial acceleration of thought, so that warning lights flash on your inner dashboard when it starts to come over you. Because righteousness can feel good, remember how you don't like it when others get righteous with you, and use this to motivate yourself to set down that angry barb, even if its tip might at first seem sweet. Imagine describing the issue firmly and fully, including how it's affected you and what you wish would change, without the topspin of righteousness. Keep this fair-minded account of things in mind, and whenever it's appropriate, you can choose to share it with others. Be careful about fault-finding. I grew up in a fault-finding home. Because of their own upbringing, my mother and father worried about things going wrong and were therefore quick to point out the mistakes of others. They had truly good intentions and were just trying to help. Nonetheless, I became defensive when criticized, and I acquired the habit of looking for faults in other people, especially those I was angry with. Understandable as this has been, it's created needless tension and conflict in my relationships. So pick an important relationship and see if your mind tends to scan for errors, words to take issue with, nits to pick. Then ask yourself, how much of this really matters? Much of what bothers people does not directly harm them or those they care about. There's a Zen story that illustrates this. A senior monk and a junior monk with strict vows of celibacy were on a journey and came upon a beautiful woman at the edge of a muddy river. The older monk offered to carry her across. She gratefully accepted, and he did so. Then she went on her way. Afterward, the two monks continued on their path. For the next hour, the younger one kept obsessing to himself, thinking things like, how could he have held her warm, soft body in his arms, feeling her sweet breath upon his neck? How terrible that he kept smelling her beautiful long hair. Finally, he confronted the other man and burst out with what he'd been thinking. The senior monk listened, then smiled gently and said, I set her down on the other side of the river, but you've been carrying her ever since. If you've grown preoccupied with the faults and failings of others, imagine how good it would feel to set these down yourself. Slow it down. In your brain, information flows along multiple major paths, like the branching and intertwining channels of a river. A key pathway of incoming information goes through the subcortical sensory switchboard, the thalamus, and then it forks. One branch connects to the amygdala, the brain's ancient alarm bell, among other functions. The other branch leads to the recently evolved prefrontal cortex, which is the center of complex thought, careful planning, and nuanced understanding of other people. Located next to the thalamus, the amygdala gets